Thelema, Coast to Coast, Show 13, October 9th, 2005. Should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast, the podcast for the exploration of Thelema, Aleister Crowley, the New Eon, Ceremonial Magic, and the Occult. I'm John Crow, and I bring you this program a couple times a month to explore Thelema and occultism as it is manifesting today in the beginning of the 21st century. There are four ways to get in touch with the show. The first is email, podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com, the blog, which is on livejournal.com/community/ThelemaCTC, a comment on the website, ThelemaCoastToCoast.com, or through our voicemail, 206-20-AGAPE, or 206-202-4273. Speaking of voicemail, here's one from a listener out in Las Vegas.
Hello, John. My name is Scholar, and I am from Las Vegas, Serpentine Splendor Lodge. I'm also the lodge secretary of Serpentine Splendor Lodge. I came across your podcast tonight, and I'm excited about it. I listened to it and loved it. Thank you very much, my friend. 93.
Now, regarding the blog and website, I'm working on a site redesign. This site is going to combine the blog, a forum, voting, and it'll even have a postcard picture gallery. In addition to this podcast, I've also recently been interviewed on the Wicked podcast. And as you might notice on this show, I tend to exhibit the opinions of my guests more than myself. So if you're interested in hearing my views on Thelema, I would encourage you go to the Wicked podcast. I'll have a link to that podcast on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. Also recently, another podcast that I listened to called Lance and Grail, a pagan podcast, did a two-show discussion of the history of Wicca. And on one of the shows, the host interviewed a representative from the organization Covenant of the Goddess. And unfortunately, some of the information that this representative stated was incorrect. So I have recorded a response and a correction, including some source materials that I submitted to the show, and the last podcast carried that information. If you're interested in hearing that, I'll have a link to that podcast on the website also. Now, a few shows ago, I talked about stickers, and those stickers are on order, and they should be mailed out to me around October 15th and arriving in 4 to 5 days. So I will have all the stickers mailed out to the people who have sent postcards by the end of the month. But that still gives everybody plenty of time to send postcards. And even when the stickers do arrive, that doesn't mean you can't send a postcard. I've ordered plenty of them. To get a sticker, all you have to do is send a postcard to Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, that's M-A-R-I-E-T-T-A, 30065. And I will get that sticker out to you as soon as possible. Between the last show and this one, received a couple more postcards. The first is from Greg in Turlock, California. He sent a very interesting postcard that has a bunch of stamps on the front. It looks like a neo-Dada kind of look on it. And I've also received a postcard from Salem, Massachusetts, saying, Halloween greetings from Salem. And it is from Jay in Salem, and Jay's a member of K KTO, so thank you very much. All of these postcards will be scanned in, and they will be available at the postcard gallery that is on the upcoming website redesign. So this is your chance to go out and find a cool postcard and send it in, and it'll get on the website, and it'll also get you a sticker. Anyway, on to the show. Our first interview is with Anacreia King of Core Lucas. This is a Thelemic organization out in Los Angeles who has married the Golden Dawn structure with Thelema and helps people work in a group environment towards obtaining knowledge and conversation. The second interview is a further discussion with Keith418 regarding a more in-depth look at how class differences and values are affecting the Thelemic community and in particular its leaders. The last interview is with author Jason Augustus Newcomb. He has a new book out called Sexual Sorcery, A Complete Guide to Sex Magic. Anyway, let's get into the first interview with Anacreia King of Core Lucas.
We have on the phone with us Anacreia King from Core Lucas. Are you there, Anna?
I am.
Welcome to the podcast, 93.
Thank you, 93.
So, as far as I understand, Core Lucas was founded in 1998 by yourself in Los Angeles?
That is true.
Can you start by telling me how the organization was founded and why? Because I understand that it is a melding of Thelema and the Golden Dawn structure.
It certainly is. The whole idea of putting a Thelemic underpinning to the Golden Dawn rituals was first started way back in, several years before we were actually founded. And the whole purpose came from the AA, because we had noticed that people who started in the AA more often during the probationary period dropped out than continued. And so the idea was, let's form something that will allow a person to get through that whole probationary work in a group situation, which of course is very contradictory to the AA philosophy, and have peer pressure, with not very much emphasis on the pressure, be the motivating force to try and get more people really into serious work. It actually has worked pretty well. Now, when Core Lucas was formed, we were attracting people that sometimes had very little knowledge of Thelema, but they were interested in a Golden Dawn type situation. So rather than providing something for people who might want to do specifically the AA work instead, we're teaching Thelema to a bunch of people that would otherwise not be nearly as well informed. So it's had an interesting evolution.
Now, the goals of the order are to educate people for the preliminary work. Would you even describe it as maybe a preparatory school for the AA?
It could be viewed that way. The direction that we have been going, I would say, it's not so much that. I state our goal as to assist people to find what their true will really is, and then to assist them in getting on and doing it. And that's a major project. Most people don't know what their true will is, even if they're 75. And so we start with a group of people who are actually of a wide age range. Some of the younger ones are really struggling to have any idea where in the world they're going. And through our graded initiatory system, there is a lot of self-examination that happens, and that all leads toward more information for them to finally sort out what is this magical thing called the true will.
Okay. Now, do a lot of people who have gone through Core Lucas, do they get to a point where they leave it and go on to the AA, or is it an organization that you work to the top of it and you keep working with it, or do you get to some point of attainment and you leave the order? How does that work exactly?
It works several ways. Sometimes you get to the top, and then you turn around and give service by assisting the newer initiates who are coming up. Sometimes they get to the top and they leave and do their own thing. It probably is some sort of a variation on what I've started. But, you know, some people just are structured that way. They have to form something of their own in order to feel like they're being productive.
Now, you said it's an initiation-based organization?
Yes, definitely.
How many initiations are there?
There are two initiations, one to the outer order and one to the inner order. However, there are a number of steps in between, and those are all as a result of work accomplished, material learned, rituals done, and time passed. At the end of every one of those accomplishments, then a person is put through a very lovely ceremony, and that marks that passage, and then they go on to another level of work.
So they're not necessarily sub-initiations, but there are intermediary ceremonies or milestones.
That's right.
And how is advancement judged? You take initiation, say, into the outer order, and you're given a curriculum?
Yes. The packet of material that's issued is probably an inch and a half thick, and there is just a mountain of information in that, and there are a couple of papers that specifically lay out the task that is required, the steps that are to be taken, the material that is to be learned. In the early levels, there's a lot of material to simply be learned and tested on. And then as they go on up through the outer order, there's more and more things that require their creative work, less memorization and memorization and regurgitation.
And so you're saying some people, when they reach the inner order and they finish their coursework, and theoretically the goal is to understand themselves, have knowledge of their true will, maybe, do you even use the term knowledge in conversation?
Yes.
Okay. So ultimately, when a student receives knowledge and conversation, they have completed their coursework with the organization. Is that correct?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Sometimes they get that a little bit early, and that's just great. But they go ahead and finish because there are still things to be added, you know?
Okay. But sometimes they decide to stay and be an administrator or help with the organization.
Correct.
So how is the organization structured? Is it, you're the head, you said.
Yes.
Is it a hierarchy-based organization?
It is a hierarchy. I call it a benevolent hierarchy. We have a governing body of three people, and they make the decisions for the group. And it's, you know, it's those mundane kind of things like taking care of finding a meeting place and handling the finances and handling the distribution of papers. It's all that kind of thing that we release our members from, for the most part, so that they can concentrate on their studies.
Now, are there membership dues?
Yes, enough to cover our costs of rent and printing.
Okay.
And that's about it.
All right. So the organization, by intent, has a very low overhead.
Very low, just as low as we can make it.
Okay. What other kind of commitments, other than actually doing the work, do students have to make? Do they have to actually come to Los Angeles, regardless of where they're at, to take initiation?
Yes.
And how frequently do they have to come to Los Angeles?
If we accept someone from out of town, we require that they commit to be willing to come once a year. Our group is set up on group work, And we make that really clear to anyone who applies from out of town, because they are going to miss a huge part of it, because they simply will not be here to participate in the group work. But in a few cases, we will take someone, and they will do all of their work long distance and then come in for their attunement work.
Is there goals in the system to set up locations in other places other than Los Angeles, or is that currently not a goal?
It's not a goal. It's something we would certainly consider if we suddenly found ourselves with a group of interested people in some locale.
And how is Core Lucas different from other Thelemic organizations, or even an organization like the Thelemic Golden Dawn, which also, like you, is attempting to use the Golden Dawn structure and Thelema?
You know, because I am not on the inside of any of the other organizations, I can't really answer that question. I can tell you a few things about us that may be different, and
okay.
I don't know. We have bent over backwards to make sure that there is no sexism in any of the rituals, any of the work, anything connected with the order. We have definitely emphasized Thelema, and there are not very many Christian references in the rituals, and the Golden Dawn had a lot.
What role does Crowley play as, you know, quote, prophet of Thelema within Core Lucas?
He's a sage.
And can you expand on that and what you mean by a sage?
We don't get into Crowleyanity.
Uh-huh.
We think that the man had a great deal to say that was very worthwhile, and we aren't as fond of some other things. And so we emphasized those things in which we thought he was just brilliant. And we don't require an extensive reading of Crowley, though some people choose to do that.
And if somebody wanted to get in touch with Core Lucas, how would they do so?
www.corelucas.org, and I'll spell Core Lucas, all one word, C-O-R-L-U-C-A-S.
Is there anything else you would like to mention for listeners who may be considering contacting the organization?
Just one little thing. There is often, in connection with magical orders, a distrust of the fact that, as they put it, we're a secret society. And I always tell people, we don't keep secrets. The information that we have, that we work with the Kabbalah and the Tarot and astrology and all that sort of thing, that material we talk about in the classes we give every Tuesday night, it's open. And we don't even think about keeping secrets, but we do keep silence about who our other members are, because that's their business to tell, and exactly how our rituals are. We don't publish our rituals. We talk about what they're about, but not precisely what they are. And this just has a sense of containment in the group that gives it a very close-knit feeling.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you being on the podcast and taking the time to talk to me. And
well, you are so welcome.
And if there's anything else we can do, please let us know.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. 93.
In our next segment, I have a further discussion with Keith 418 about class and its implications. In particular, we take a look at the middle class values, and the effects that's having on the Thelemic community and the leaders within the Thelemic community.
Keith, 93, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me, John. 93 to you.
In our last discussion, we were talking about class issues and particularly class issues within the Thelemic community. Some of the points that we touched were that the leadership were middle class, while the majority of the membership were working class. We spent a few moments on that, but I don't think we really looked at it too closely.
I think one of the things you want to look at is the way the leadership of the Philemon community starting in the early 90s has become more and more dominated by people with middle-class backgrounds or with a middle-class agenda. They're not always the same, but they usually are. And I think it's important to see what the best way of becoming a leader in the OTO is for any Philemon group. One of the things that I find fascinating is that, let's just say, you know, you're at the average Minerval, you're first degree, someone who's just joined the organization. How would you become a leader in the OTO? What's the steps for leadership development, leadership training? The group needs leaders. You know, obviously, there's a leadership demand across the country, but how are leaders trained? You know, what should you be thinking about if you want to become a leader in the OTO? And what's fascinating to me when you look at that question is that there aren't any articles in any of the OTO newsletters about how people became leaders. And we have a 10th degree in the United States. What did they do to become a 10th degree? How did they set out to become one? Does our 10th degree ever reveal that at some point he said, it's my will to be the 10th degree of the OTO in the USA? Can anyone kind of conceive of there being an article in the newsletter instructing people to say, look, if you want to be a leader in the OTO, these are the things that you should be doing? And, you know, a while ago, somebody said to me, well, I'm seen as being one of your friends. I'm seen as being one of the people that you interact with on the internet. Is that going to hurt my chances for development, leadership development in the organization? I said, absolutely not. As long as you are middle class, own your own home, drive a fairly nice car, have responsible middle-class values, they will give you every leadership degree in the OTO they can, because that's what's most important. Now, you could turn around and look at this and say, well, what if this person really isn't interested in Aleister Crowley? Doesn't matter. What if this person really doesn't know anything about ceremonial magic or the occult? Doesn't matter at all. As long as they'll do the things the OTO wants and maintain a middle-class sort of demeanor and way of life, that person, they will lay them down with every leadership responsibility they can. And I think we've seen this pretty much across the country. Well, what does that really mean? What are the long-term effects of that? And as new people come in and look at the group and sort of see that Aleister Crowley and his teachings and the challenges that he gave us are not really on the radar screen anymore to the extent that, you know, one might expect from reading the books, then we begin to look at what the real purpose of the organization is, what the leaders are really interested in, and it seems that they're less really concerned about the Crowley material and more concerned with, you know, promoting their class allies and having a stable, respectable middle-class group. Well, isn't that going to create some conflicts?
But don't we need stable people within the leadership to run the order? I mean, you cannot be a leader of a body or a chapter or even Grand Lodge if you're couch surfing, if you don't have steady income, if you can't fly to the meetings across the country, if you can't be an SGIG,
right.
If you can't
travel around and investigate. Right. But here's the problem in that if you do all those things, how good a occultist or magician are you ever really going to be? I mean, see, this is the problem. Crowley did not spend his life watching television and smoking pot on somebody's couch or basically engaged in, like, the equivalent kinds of behaviors of bums and lazy people. He wrote hundreds of books. He traveled around the world. You know, he was often in difficult circumstances, and often he had money and did quite well. But he was constantly producing, constantly working. Our leaders are sort of in a weird situation in that their real allegiance is less to the sort of challenge perspective that Crowley taught, and their real allegiances in terms of the way their lives are defined are towards being good middle-class agents and believing what every other good middle-class person believes. And the problem is that that may be great in terms of their own stability and their own, you know, way of life in capitalist consumer society, but it's not so great when it comes to actually being leaders of a Philemic or a cult organization. And people are discovering this. The newer members are coming in saying, these people don't really know anything about the Crowley material. And they don't. They really are not that interested in it. And if they are, it's in a very detached academic sense. I mean, there's an old-fashioned joke. How do you communicate with a monster? Oh, long distance. that this is how people view Crowley. They view him from the long distance of academic objectivity, of scholarly study, of all the sort of approaches that are normative for middle-class people when they look at dangerous subjects. The idea of a full immersion into Crowley's teaching and way of life would be horrifying to most of these people because their entire lives are structured around avoiding that kind of challenge and that kind of situation. But the result is that they're running an organization whose basic ideals and positions they don't understand, aren't interested in, and oppose.
It goes back to that paradox where you're asking them to be responsible people to work towards goals that will ultimately undermine their class positions.
And their highest values, yes. And I think when Crowley talked about stability or commitment, he meant stability and commitment that would transcend the ups and downs of material life or the challenges of being an occultist. He stayed the same. He stayed true to Thelema throughout his entire life after receiving the Book of the Law. And that sort of stability and commitment is very different from avoiding danger, playing everything safe, avoiding absolutes, using relativism to shield yourself from critique, all of the sort of strategies of playing it safe and being stable that the middle class employ. And yeah, we need stable people, but do we need people who are stable in their commitment to Crowley, Thelema, and his teachings, or do we need stable people who don't take any risks, don't take any chances, and can pay their bills on time every day, every week, or whatever? And that's a very different kind of question. And I think the stability that we need has been defined by the middle class on their terms. It hasn't really been defined for them on Crowley's terms. So that's one of the things we need to look at and challenge them with. I mean, John, look, there is no more for me, and probably for you, and for probably many of your listeners, there is no more challenging philosophic, magical, or occult system than what Crowley has presented us. If there was something that was more challenging and more difficult in a certain sense, I think we would be out doing it. But that sort of challenge is not really what we're seeing in the Thelema community anymore. I mean, when was the last time you saw the leaders challenging us to any extent? Whereas if you open a Crowley book at random, all it is are challenges. Now, I really feel this reaction against challenge and towards safety is a result of them being more and more middle class. And middle class people are very safe. They don't like risks. They don't take risks. They, you know, ride their bikes with their helmets, they use their seatbelts, they go to the doctor a lot, they worry about their diets. These are all things that are part of middle-class life, of being fearful, of playing it safe, that don't make you a good magician.
It seems to me that you're setting up a dichotomy between being a good magician means that you take lots of risks, somebody might even say reckless, or are you going to play it safe and therefore not take any risks and therefore be a bad magician?
Well, how much of magical progress involves crises and risk-taking? I mean, one of the major differences I think I have between my perspective and the leaders of the OTO is that they don't really believe that change or growth comes through crisis. They think change and stability are best achieved without any crisis at all. Whereas if you look at Crowley, you know, he basically said at one point that he was able to just create crises in the lives of people around him. And as we study his life, we see that this was the case. You know, if you met Aleister Crowley and took him seriously for a little while, you were pretty much guaranteed some sort of life crisis pretty soon after that happened. So when you look at our current leaders, do they believe that growth and change that's positive comes through crisis, or does it come for them by avoiding crisis? And that's the dichotomy. Are we going to accept that certain growth is going to come through a crisis? If we do, then we're going to be at odds with the people who are constantly trying all their lives to avoid any crisis whatsoever. You can't have it both ways.
As far as I can tell, the initiations are supposed to cause some kind of spiritual, personal crisis, and that's how you grow.
Right.
So
that's the way I always saw it, either, you know, in terms of the real serious initiations or even the sort of approximation of those serious initiations that you see in OTO degree.
Is there corresponding aspects to being a leader within the organization? Should there be other kinds of crises that are created by just day-to-day being in the order or being a leader in the order or being a member of the order? Or should the crises be contained within the initiations only so that it is a stair-step system So that is just
how can you have a personal crisis not bleed over into other aspects of your life? To try to say that you can have a crisis within an initiation, within a degree, or within one particular ritual, and not have it go anywhere outside of that little time and space compartment is absurd. That is nothing like what Crowley wrote or suggested. What I'm basically saying is that I think that sometimes crises can be profound and important and powerful and ways to actually grow. And what I see more and more from the middle-class leaders of the OTO is a reaction against crises. They don't like crises because they create problems and stress, and they're not safe. You don't always know how a crisis is going to turn out. So you work to alleviate that crisis, and that comes through avoiding confrontation, through avoiding failure or goals that you may not be able to attain, from all of these sorts of tasks and planning that could foment crisis. I mean, we often say this, that if there was a lot of strategic planning, there would be a crisis because people would have to decide whether they were down with the plan and down with the direction of the order or not. That would promote a crisis. Well, the leaders of the OTO don't want any crisis. They live their whole lives avoiding a crisis of one kind or another. So consequently, we don't have plans, we don't have goals, we don't have opportunities to grow because the leaders are so busy working to make sure there never is any crisis because they don't want to see anyone get unhappy or possibly fail or have to struggle with one. And I think this is very unfortunate.
So where does the leadership look to correct this?
Well, I think increasingly it looks to its own basic values, which are middle class and which are, you know, secular humanist, as you pointed out. And, you know, the basic ways that middle class people tend to try to resolve their problems and to put off having a crisis. And the problem with that is that a lot of times those solutions are not healthy. They involve avoidance. They involve, as I said, using relativism as a way to avoid criticism from others and judgments from others. They basically use all the strategies and scams that they can to avoid having a crisis. Whereas, you know, Crowley was all about running around provoking a crisis. Now, there may be a compromise between those two sorts of visions and processes, but let's face it, Crowley was all about creating challenges and provoking people. Our current leadership has moved 180 degrees away from that, where now all they're concerned about is pacifying people, making sure there aren't any conflicts or crises, and not challenging anyone at all. But how is that magical?
Status quo is not creating change in conformity with will. Even if you are doing your will, it's still change in conformity, and you cannot maintain the status quo and have that change at the same time.
Yeah, I don't see how it's possible. And you know, what comes down to us a lot of the time is we look at this and say, well, do they really want any change? Some of them will say that they do, but when you ask them, well, what will you give up in order to get that change that you want, then, you know, the conversation stops.
Well, I had a conversation recently with a guy, and we talked about that whole aspect of sacrifice. If you look at World War II, the whole country was behind the war. They saw the need of the war. They sacrificed for it. They gave up food. They gave up fuel, metal, rubber. They bought bonds. Now you look at this American culture. We're at war. Nobody really wants to be in this war and make a sacrifice. They're okay if people go over there and handle it as long as they can go out and still buy their things and get their whatever they want. But now that gas has gone up, there's no sacrifice there, and that's the culture. So it's not too surprising that the leadership, who identifies with the majority of society, feels the same way and doesn't want to make any sacrifices for the order.
Yeah, and I think that that's very significant. And a lot of times they say, look, I am sacrificing. I'm making sacrifices of time. I am doing things. And I think we need to, you know, remember that there are people all over the country working very hard for the OTO who are making sacrifices of time and often a lot of money because they're tolerating people who won't make any sacrifices at all and carrying their share of it. And I don't want to suggest that there aren't sincere people that aren't making sacrifices. The problem is that the real crises that the organization needs to grow, that kind of conversation doesn't really happen. And more often, I think the people who are making the sacrifices burn out and are replaced by new people who probably haven't been paying attention, who take on those sacrifices until they get burned out and they leave. And there's a, you know, fairly high turnover when it comes to that sort of thing that you can observe in certain areas. It's unfortunate, but I think it comes from the sort of middle-class value that's become very dominant of avoid confrontation, avoid conflict, avoid critique, avoid judgment, keep the status quo going, don't make waves. And again, I mean, that works really well in corporate America. It doesn't really work that well for a magical organization that was designed by Aleister Crowley. And I think that's where the conflicts begin to occur. They're trying to run it one way where it was really designed another, and consequently it becomes dysfunctional. And rather than looking at their own values and saying, hey, maybe we don't really know what we're doing, or maybe we're operating this the wrong way, they tend to, as you know, blame Aleister Crowley. It's his fault. It's his problem. He designed it wrong. He did a bad job. Because the idea of actually confronting their own values and looking at themselves critically is something that they can't seem to do. I would argue that if they can't do it, they've never really been initiated.
I think that's a good amount of material for the listeners to process and digest, and we'll continue this conversation about class or some related topic on the next podcast. So thanks for being on again.
Well, thanks for having me, John. 93.
Now we're going to hear from author Jason Augustus Newcomb. Jason has three books out through Red Wheel Wiser, and they're all about magic, thelemic magic, in a variety of ways. His first book is a modernization of the Abramelin working. His second book is called The New Hermetics. And the third book is Sexual Sorcery, The Complete Guide to Sex Magic, and is a practical book about performing sex magic. So now we'll hear from Jason talk about his background, his books, and also the program in which he is working with students on New Hermetics.
We have on the phone with us Jason Augustus Newcomb. Are you there, Jason?
I am.
Welcome to the podcast, 93.
93.
For those who don't know you, you are an author published by Red Wheel Wiser, and you have three books out: 21st Century Mage, Bring Down the Divine to Earth; The New Hermetics, 21st Century Magic for Illumination and Power; and your newest book, Sexual Sorcery, A Complete Guide to Sexual Magic. How long have you been published?
The first book was published in 2002, but I actually wrote it in 1999. And it's actually sort of an interesting story, because the first person that I actually sent my manuscript to, or actually I'm not sure if I sent the manuscript, but I know I sent a query, was someone named John Crow, who has a publishing house called Luxor Publishing.
It's funny. I do remember something about that.
He turned me down. But then I sent it, the second person that I sent it to was Wiser, and they took it.
Actually, if I remember correctly, I said this wasn't something that I could publish, but I recommended that you go to Wiser.
You did. You did. You were actually very nice and very personable. You know, it wasn't one of those rejection letters where you just simply get, you know, thank you, this isn't something we're currently considering right now. You were very personal about it. So I appreciated that. And I never took it as an offense in the slightest. So.
Well, that's good. Just so our listeners who aren't familiar with your works, can you summarize what each book is about?
Sure. My first book, which is called 21st Century Mage, was originally titled The Knowledge and Conversation of Your Holy Guardian Angel. And basically, it is a manual describing the way in which to approach the Abramelin operation from a modern perspective. And I give basically all of the medieval instructions that are in it to a chapter, but I also kind of go away from that and describe how you can really approach it from, you know, our modern lives, which, with the many differences that we have from the ancient times. I mean, for instance, there's one of the instructions is that you need to bathe at least once a week because you need to be clean for the operation. And that sort of thinking pervades the whole Abramelin manuscript. You know, and it's a different way of looking at the world than we currently have. Of course, most of us bathe every single day, sometimes twice a day, and so the instruction to bathe once a week is somewhat out of date. There are a lot of instructions like that in the book,
right.
And I basically tried to look at it from a realistic perspective, and also from the perspective of a person who's a Thelemic magician and who has, you know, working with the writings of Aleister Crowley for a long time, and how those are sort of update the ideas that were in the original Abramelin manuscript with a lot of more contemporary magical ideas and practices.
When you were thinking about the Abramelin work, what made you think that there was a need out in the market for an updated version of it? Had you heard people say that the Abramelin working was too difficult or didn't make sense for today?
I definitely had heard most people that I was in conversation with saying that they basically were ruling out the idea of ever performing anything like the Abramelin operation because it was too complicated and too long-term. And I had actually had a copy of that book since the time I was about 14 and had read it a mazillion times and had always felt like, well, although it is a time and spirit-consuming endeavor, it's not nearly as hard as it sounds at first glance, because the instructions in it are actually laid out in three separate books, and different phrases sort of modify what the person is saying in different parts of the book. So, I mean, if you take the instructions as a whole, it gives a slightly different perspective than if you just take one section of it. I mean, for instance, there is a place that says you should build your temple in a quiet forest, but it doesn't say that you need to spend 6 months in that quiet forest. In fact, that temple is really just for the last 7 days of the practice, where you're invoking the Holy Guardian Angel and then the demon. The rest of the practice can be conducted in a room in your house, and in fact, that's what they suggest. And he also doesn't suggest that you quit your job or that you need to in any way really nullify your life in order to do the practice. It suggests that it's even possible for a person who's an indentured servant to do the practice, although that would probably be a little bit harder than for a person who's a free man who can do it on his own. There's also really the only time that women are brought up in it are in that they shouldn't try it, and that you shouldn't be with your wife when she's at her time of the month. So it completely basically negates females trying to do the operation, which to me seems really ludicrous in this day and age when so many women are actively engaged in this kind of work. So that's another thing that I felt really needed to be updated. But for what specifically inspired me to write it is I was wanting to pursue that work myself. And I started to write down my thoughts on it, and then I did the working, and then I completed the manuscript, and that was basically how that came to be.
So at the end of the working, did you obtain knowledge and conversation?
I obtained the knowledge and conversation of my Holy Guardian Angel as far as I understand that concept. I'm sure that there are people out there that would say, oh, no, Jason didn't, because my belief system says that the knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel consists of this, this, or this, which obviously Jason hasn't obtained since he is simply a mere mortal. To my way of thinking, yes, I did.
Okay. Well, let's move to your second book, The New Hermetics. Can you explain what The New Hermetics are?
Well, The New Hermetics came from a similar place to The 21st Century Mage in that basically I was doing a bunch of magical work and feeling like a lot of my contemporaries and the people around me were not pursuing a lot of magical work because it seemed too hard and it seemed too time-consuming. And so I tried to lay out my sort of simplified ideas on a number of tools that could be used to augment and facilitate the sort of inner theurgic quest for divinity, as well as some practical ideas that I was learning from various other things like neuro-linguistic programming. And I incorporated those into the practices in a way that I think is fairly cool.
So if somebody purchased your book and started working through it, what kind of results should they expect?
Well, I've actually had the wonderful pleasure of being able to work with about, I think it's up to about 12 people right now who are actually working through the system. I have a set of CDs that basically go through all of the tools that are in the book. So they are using the CDs and then meeting with me twice a week over the phone and going over their progress. And really, everyone's been having really phenomenal results. The thing about The New Hermetics is some people who have read it uncarefully have thought that it's really just a set of sort of guided inner meditations, which it really isn't. The vast focus of it is actually on doing practical things in your life to improve your life, and action is really the cornerstone of it all. And you set a series of goals, and you go about obtaining those goals by balancing yourself out and by invoking various qualities into yourself in order to obtain those goals. And there's a bunch of actions that you take in your day-to-day life. There isn't a tremendous amount of ritual involved in it, but it does take place actively in the physical world as well as in the spiritual world. It's not just a set of sort of fluffy meditations.
So it would be very difficult for a, quote, armchair magician to pick up this book and work with this book because it's a very do or action-oriented book.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's two different things that are being talked about when people talk about armchair magicians. On the one hand, there are people who simply like to read a lot of books and actively consider themselves not to be real magicians. But I also think that there are a lot of people sitting in armchairs who are doing some interesting magic. I don't think that sitting in an armchair precludes you necessarily from being a part of an active spiritual life that does cause change and conformity with will.
Before we get into your next book, let's talk a little bit about your background. How did you get into magic? You've already stated that you started reading about it in your early teens with the Abra Melin working. What got you into magic, and where has your path taken you?
Interestingly, I actually first became acquainted with magic when I was about 11 years old, when I was involved in a Sunday school at a Unitarian Universalist church where we would talk about various different kinds of religion. And one week, the teacher brought in this little book that was a book about different forms of divination from around the world, and it had, you know, the I Ching in it, and reading tea leaves, and hand reading, and it had a series of tarot images in it. And the tarot images just really captured my imagination, and I was like, this is something that, there's obviously something concealed in this, in these symbols that is just so different and important, and something that I really need to know more about. So there was a local New Age store that I went to, and I purchased a pack of tarot cards. Actually, initially, I went in there with the intention of redrawing by hand all of the tarot images, and I asked them if I could look at a deck, and I sort of started sketching them out, and then I realized that that was impractical. And so I eventually purchased the deck from them, and I started studying the little pamphlet that came with the tarot deck and giving people readings, but I quickly realized from encountering that store that there was witchcraft and other forms of magic that people were actually doing, and I'd never heard of such a thing, and it really captured my heart very quickly, and I started purchasing books. I purchased Raymond Buckland's Complete Guide to Witchcraft, and I think I purchased an Enochian magic book by the Schulers, and I purchased Magic in Theory and Practice by Aleister Crowley, and the Book of the Sacred Magic of Abra Melin and the Mage after that a little bit. And I remember when I actually have an old notebook from when I was 13 or 14 or 15. I'm not sure exactly the year because I didn't put dates and things back then. But, and actually there's like these concerns that I'm expressing because the magic that I'd been exploring before then, the Enochian and the what Aleister Crowley was writing about and the witchcraft, it seemed like out of harmony with what the Abra Melin operation was, because he tells you to ignore astrology and to ignore signs and seals and magical talismans, that all of that stuff is, you know, negative, bad magic, and only the sacred magic of Abra Melin and the Mage is what we should all be pursuing. And so there was this dichotomy in me, because I was really interested in the symbols of the tarot, and yet the Abra Melin operation really appealed to me as well. So I struggled with that for a long time, and maybe eventually the fruition of that was the book that I wrote many years later. Basically, from then, I studied the stuff, and I actually involved my youth group at the Unitarian Universalist Church in a number of sort of goetic operations of conjuring demons, which always managed to irritate the confirmed atheists in the group and frighten the hell out of the true believers in the group. we had to abandon it after a few experiments because people were getting too weirded out by the whole thing. So after that, I continued to basically do little things on my own for a long time and got caught up in, you know, girls and high school and whatnot, and basically left it off for a period of time, but continued reading and studying it all, and then actively got into it about at the age of 18, and basically have been practicing keeping fairly detailed journals from at different periods for many years now.
In your book, you mention Thelema actually through all of your books. So when did you accept Thelema as your prominent magical path?
I think I have a very different story than most people with that, in that I had read Aleister Crowley's Magic in Theory and Practice, the old Dover edition of it, and I had Aleister Crowley's Book of Thoth, and I loved those books. But my least favorite part of them was actually the parts where he'd sort of wax on for pages about Thelema and the Law of Thelema and how he had received it from Iwas, and all that stuff to me seemed like he was trying to build a cult, and I really resisted that. I was like, well, this guy's obviously a genius, but I just really, this Thelema stuff, I don't know what the hell he's talking about. And it wasn't until about 1996 when I first encountered the OTO that I was like, well, you know what? this stuff is pretty cool and these people are pretty cool. I guess I'm going to accept the law of Thelema. So basically, it was definitely the sort of like cult thinking that got me into accepting the Book of the Law. Since then, it's really become an important part of my psychology in unconscious ways that enrich and sometimes disturb me to this day.
All right, well, let's get into your newest book, Sexual Sorcery, A Complete Guide to Sex Magic.
Yeah.
When did you start working with sexual magic techniques as part of your spirituality or magic practice?
Well, let me insert one thing before I get into that.
Okay.
Which is that the A Complete Guide to Sex Magic was inserted by the publisher.
Okay. So that's not necessarily your claim.
Well, you know, it ends up turning out to be my claim because my name's on the book, so I have to accept it and simply go forward with the karma that is created by that. But basically, I would say around the time that I joined the OTO, I really wasn't familiar with sex magic at all. I still have my old Dover copy of Magic and Theory and Practice, and nearly all the places where Crowley obliquely references sex magic have, like, parentheses and pen around them with question marks saying, you know, what is he talking about here? You know, this secret Sabbath of the Adepts. You know, I'm not sure what that is. And then the culture within the OTO, within about a few weeks, I realized that, in fact, what he was talking about in those things was sex magic. And with that in mind, and the fact that I'd religiously read the book cover to cover several times, I pretty instantly understood exactly what he was talking about with sex magic.
Right.
And then I went on to study some of his other writings, and it becomes even more clear when you put everything together. Libera Lef, for instance, is pretty much straight up a manual of sex magic written in alchemical and Kabbalistic terms.
Now, within the first paragraph of your introduction, it's got a pretty bold claim. Improve your orgasm or even achieve spiritual transcendence through sex. You can learn all of that and more in this book. Is that true?
Can you imagine?
I mean, that's one heck of a way to sell a book, don't you think?
And it really is true. And not so much because of the brilliance of my writing, but because of the wonderful merits of sexual magic. Those things really are true.
I notice in some of the early chapters, you include some typical magical operations, such as the various pentagram rituals, hexagram rituals. Why did you think it was necessary to put those in? Did you want this to be a single comprehensive book?
Well, yeah, I wanted to include things that would allow a person to simply jump in and not have me say, well, before you get involved in sex magic, you really ought to read this book and this book and this book. But also simply because I think a lot of practitioners are probably going to involve ritual elements in their work, at least at first, and I wanted to have it be a book that people could use for that purpose, not just for sex, but for ritual-oriented sex as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, throughout the book, you make a distinction between Eastern systems and Western systems. Why do you make that distinction? Is it an important distinction?
Well, the book is really focused on the work of three people, which is Pascal Beverly Randolph, Lewis Culling, and Aleister Crowley, who if we reverse Culling and Crowley, sort of form a timeline of the Western sex magic being semi-public. And it's from there that I really wanted to draw, for the purposes of this book, the practices of sexual magic. But there is a limit to what they actually wrote about those subjects. They don't really talk much, although they do sort of refer to, they kind of make reference to chakras and whatnot in their writings, but they don't refer to any real specific Eastern practices that can augment your work. And I wanted to give some more information, so I do provide a few Eastern things within it, because there's a lot of sort of corrective things that we need to do as Westerners in order to turn our magic or our sex into magic. We aren't used to using our sexual energy for anything other than sex, for the most part. I mean, I know that there are going to be some magicians who say, oh, no, that's not true. I use my sexual energy all the time in my magic. And that's true. But there are a number of Eastern techniques that help to sort of unlock the flow of that energy more readily. And I wanted to include those, but I wanted to make the distinction that those aren't necessarily out of the Western tradition at all.
I also noticed in the book a number of the tarot cards and illustrations. Did you draw those?
I did. I painted those.
That goes back to your desire to recreate the tarot, is that correct?
Yeah, it's the fulfillment of my youthful desire.
Excellent. Now, I noticed there's also some Goetic work, Kabbalistic. You incorporate a lot of those different systems inside the book, is that correct?
Yeah, I really only gloss over them, referring to the fact that you could develop your sexual magic in those directions, and I give sort of generalized instructions for how one would approach doing that. I don't spend a huge amount of time on anything because, you know, it is a fairly comprehensive book that talks about a lot of different subjects.
And it also seems to me that it's a very, similar to your New Hermetics, a very practical book. It's got lots of exercises and pretty direct discussion of sexual activity, positions, ritual, meditations, and so forth.
Yeah, I think that if I were to define my writing style in general as a magical author, it is as a person who wants to take the occult out of magic. In that I think so many people sort of half reveal what it is they're even trying to explain in their writing. So I've really tried to as fully as possible explain the roots of things. And I haven't really spent a tremendous amount of energy on the fluff, which anyone can get anywhere. You know, the specific cultural baggage that you can apply to magic. I try and get to the sort of root causes of things. And also I try and address, with the sex magic book, I try and address what sex magic means to a relationship or to a person who's, you know, pursuing it from a practical perspective, not just simply, you know, all you have to do is put your penis inside the girl and not come for a half an hour. There's a lot more to the dynamic of sex between human beings than just simply the act of sex itself. There's the communication that's necessary. There's the sort of the way in which you need to approach a partner and say, look, I'm interested in having sex magic with you. That's very different than saying, I'm interested in having sex with you. My early exploration of sex magic was fraught with a lot of people saying, no, I don't want to have sex magic with you. I just want to have sex. Let's keep the magic out of this. And I think it's important to realize that is something that you're going to encounter as you begin to try and explore this stuff. Or that people are simply going to want to just have sex magic with you and not have a relationship with you. And that's another strange hurdle that you have to get past as well.
Do you also talk about some of the ethical aspects of it?
Well, I try and address it, but I'm only one person. I have my ethical standards, but another person might have an entirely different set of ethical standards. And since I'm not into making other people's wills, you know, verboten, I wouldn't want to say you can't do this or you must do that.
Okay.
I try and just simply give my perspective and try and be realistic about things. I mean, I think a lot of people that I know of that get involved in the sort of quasi-sex magic, at least amongst the OTO community, there's a lot of sort of partner swapping that goes on and free love thinking that goes on. And I really feel like from what I've witnessed personally, that stuff frequently leads to nothing but headaches and trouble rather than transcendence and beauty.
I've seen the exact same thing in the Thelemic community, and more often than not, it always ends up in difficulties, hurt feelings, estrangement. And if it was a committed relationship, the relationship ending, whether it's just a general partnership or if it was a marriage.
Yeah, I mean, I've witnessed a couple of marriages ending. I've witnessed one of my own personal relationships ending and the relationships of a number of friends of mine ending simply because people are wanting to explore this polyamory stuff and I just watch it sort of slowly but surely breaking away at the bonds of love between two people. And that's not to say that stuff is impossible, that you can't have that kind of free love attitude, but you have to make sure that all the people involved have the same idea of what free love is and what relationship is.
Right, and then the other aspect is communication. You have to make sure everybody communicates often,
right,
clearly, and that there is no deception, because that's what causes jealousy and hurt and ends the relationship ultimately.
Right. Even just slight deception completely rocks the core of a relationship. You know, even if you have just simply not completely told everything that happened between, you know, you and Petunia, it still rots your relationship with Agatha. You know, I mean, whether or not she even ever finds out that it was true or not, you're no longer intimate with that person, really. There are secrets between you.
In your sex magic book, is it mostly a heterosexual magical book, or do you also talk on homosexual magic?
Well, I would like to say that I had more experience with homosexual magic so that I could write more about it. It's never been something that has moved me. So while I address homosexual magic in a very slight way, I'm not really able to speak about it an extremely large amount. I think that for the most part, the formulas are similar. Obviously, there's a slight change in the wavelength of things when you have two partners that have the same genitalia, but the basic principles of sex magic, I think, remain the same.
Are you going to be speaking about the book anytime soon at any places, bookstores, or doing a tour or anything?
I'm trying to get a tour together. I'd really love to be able to get some OTO bodies to help me out to places. For the New Hermetics, I tried to put something together, and then the circumstances of my life became a little bit chaotic, and I unfortunately didn't get to really promote that book as much as I would have liked to. But I'd really like to get out. So if any OTO body masters are listening, I'd love to come to your body and talk about my book at length and talk about some of the ideas that are in it and exchange ideas with the membership.
Is that offer also open to other non-OTO affiliated groups?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know those people as well, but I'd love to come and talk to any group that would have me. I live in Florida now, so if anyone's in, you know, Florida or Georgia, it would be very easy for me to get there. And I do travel for other reasons to other places as well. And I'm currently trying to schedule some workshops in various places, so it's definitely something that I'd like to do.
If somebody wanted to get in touch with you, how could they get in touch with you?
Well, my website, www.newhermetics.com, that's a good place to start, and my email address from there is jason@newhermetics.com. That's probably the easiest way to get directly in touch with me. I just want to give a little bit of a plug to my New Hermetics program, which I'm currently seeking about 5 more students to do the 6-month program with me. So far, the results have been really outstanding. So,
now, you mentioned that there were CDs. Is that commercially available CDs?
They're available from my website, yeah.
Well, thanks again for being on the podcast. It's been very informative, and I appreciate you taking the time.
I've enjoyed it quite a bit.
93.
Well, that about does it for today's show. I appreciate all the guests that were on it, and I especially appreciate all the listeners' feedback. And I encourage everybody listening to send in a postcard to get a sticker, send some feedback email. I've really appreciated a lot of the email that I've gotten. Go to the blog, go to the website, or especially call the voicemail. Again, that number is 206-20-AGAPE or 206-202-4273. The closing song is one that many people may have heard of. It's from a band called Current 93 and is called Crowley Mass. Now, this is a small album that was put out by Current 93 all about Crowley Mass on October 12th. And when contacting David Tibet to get permission to use the song, he wanted me to comment that everyone should keep in mind that this song is not to be taken serious. It was done completely in jest. So here is Crowley Mass by Current 93, and I appreciate everyone listening and hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll keep listening in the future. Love is the law, love under will.
Far away! Yeah, listen. What's place. But then a voice starts whipping round, the vision comes to play. And this is what the voice declaims. Just get the book of the law.